case for argument is Wells versus Riker. Mr. Murphy.
Good morning, Your Honor. My name is Chris Murphy.
Could you speak up? I'm having trouble hearing you.
Sorry. My name is Chris Murphy of Mayor Brown. We're representing the petitioner appellate, Johnny Wells, by appointment. And if it please the court, this is a case regarding ineffective assistance of counsel. It's a habeas appeal. And the issue is the unreasonableness of the trial counsel's failure to impeach the victims with a major material inconsistency between their trial testimonies and their police interview statements. Primarily here we're talking about a statement which they testified to at trial but which was not included in their detailed police interview statements in which they claimed at trial that Mr. Wells said, "Bitch, I told you I was going to kill you," during the incident.
But he stabbed her in the back twice. What's that except trying to kill someone?
I think the testimony, I realize that obviously he stabbed her in the back twice. That's not necessarily an effective way of killing someone depending upon where you kill them.
One stabs someone in the back without intending to kill a person. That's ridiculous. You might stab a person in the front, you know, in self-defense. You're not really thinking about killing. But to stab a person in the back? What else did you do? What kind of knife did he have?
I don't know, Your Honor. He was convicted of aggravated battery. And I think that was clearly... he was convicted of aggravated battery with respect to both Ms. Smith and also Mr. Harris.
I don't think it's realistic. And anyway, you know, omissions from police reports. Police reports are notoriously sloppy. And also, wasn't she interviewed in the hospital?
She was interviewed.
So she'd just been stabbed, and she's supposed to remember everything that
she gave a detailed
account. And he had told her previously that he was going to kill her.
When she
right?
recalled that. She didn't apparently recall the statement.
Well, if you're in a hospital and you've just been stabbed, you probably don't recall everything that went on.
Your recollection is more refreshed than you are several months later.
It's very unrealistic. It's extremely unrealistic. No way this guy is going to be acquitted because of some omission in a police report.
Well, it's not just her, Your Honor. It's also Mr. Harris. Mr. Harris was not injured. There's the same discrepancy with respect to his testimony. And he also didn't include the statement in his police interview, but he testified it to a trial. And
I think that's significant. It wasn't written down. This is the problem with the police report. They don't dictate it. They don't sign it. I'm talking about the witness. The police people write things down. And that might have been the threat that you're going to kill somebody if they said it, if they even mentioned it, but also getting stabbed in the back and getting stabbed in the shoulder and when getting in and off the bus and who got off first and all that sort of thing. There are a lot of little details, and that's the problem with the police report, why they... It might have been possible to bring this up with all the stuff else that's in the police report, which would then come in, and all the bad stuff.
There is any bad stuff that wasn't tested.
Well, to back it up, I guess, so it's just whatever. What is it going to be, aggravated battery or something?
Yes, he was convicted of aggravated battery.
For Harris.
On
Harris.
On Harris and also on... Smith. Well, on both of the victims, he was convicted of aggravated battery. But as to the police report, I think it's clear that this statement would have been included if it had been made. It wasn't just police officers here doing the interviewing. It was also an assistant state's attorney. And he would have understood the significance that the police hadn't. And also, they included in the police report a statement about a prior threat he had made.
Right. That shows the intent, right? You don't need more than that.
Well, it doesn't show contemporaneous intent.
Oh, honestly. He says he's going to kill her, then he stabs her twice in the back. So what jury is going to say that this, he just stabbed her to frighten her or something? That's ridiculous.
Jury might have a different perception of what's
I don't
happening
believe in that. I don't believe a rational jury would believe that.
This is a very important statement. Wasn't included in the police report. She turns up at trial, testifies to it. Some people who might be skeptical might think that that was embellishment and that she was lying.
The stabs weren't lies.
I agree, Your Honor, the stabs weren't lies. The other point about this failure to impeach was that it was directly contrary to the defense counsel's trial strategy, which the state and the district court and basically everyone agrees that what she was trying to do was to defend on the intent to kill element. This goes directly to the intent to kill element. This goes to him saying, while he's stabbing her, I told you I was going to kill you. So it goes directly to intent to kill. I don't think there's any excuse.
It's kind of icing on the cake at that point, though. I mean, they've got evidence of prior threats and prior assault and chasing her off the bus and standing over when she's on the ground, stabbing her twice. What he says is really icing on the cake, if he says anything at all.
Some of the evidence of prior threats is all derived from Mr. Harris and Ms. Smith. And if they are impeached and if they are revealed to the jury to be embellishing their testimony and to be inventing things that didn't happen, then we have a possibility of a jury being more skeptical about the entirety of their testimony.
There's also this bystander who's not involved who, in his police report, said something about that as well, and the defense lawyer may have feared that in choosing not to pursue this line.
That's true, Your Honor, but when he was testifying under oath, he didn't say that. He said he didn't hear that. He didn't hear anything because there was some noise. He didn't hear anyone say anything. There was some noise going on in the background. He didn't hear that. And I don't see how his police interview report gets into evidence. It's hearsay. So the fact that he might have said something to that effect.
So you're saying if she had died of these stab wounds, he would just be guilty of aggravated battery? That's your argument.
That's speculative, Your Honor.
That's your argument.
Well, you just said a minute ago that they both got convicted of aggravated battery. He got, what it says here, that he got convicted of attempted murder.
Yes, he was also convicted of aggravated battery, and the sentence for that was merged into the...
Well, yeah, but...
Yeah, obviously.
Included, yeah.
No, but I mean, the whole deal is the attempted murder. That's what your problem is here.
Yes, that's our problem. We're not going up on the aggravated battery. We're going
irrelevant.
The attempted murder. That's he's already served his time.
But your theory is that he was just guilty of aggravated battery.
That's right, Your Honor.
And that would be true even if she died.
Well, if she died, we're talking about a separate universe.
No, we're not. How would that would make no difference to your argument. Your argument is that he didn't intend to kill her. And that's true whether she dies or doesn't die,
well,
right?
If she had died, the injuries would have been different from what they were.
No kidding. But that's not the point. The point is, your argument is, there was no intent to kill, which you need for a murder conviction.
I think the argument...
So therefore, it would still have been just aggravated battery.
The argument is that if there had been a proper impeachment of these witnesses, there would have been a reasonable doubt to the jury of it, that there was an intent to kill, which is all I need to do under Strickland, is it show that there could have been a reasonable doubt if counsel...
No, not could be a reasonable doubt.
Reasonable probability of a reasonable doubt.
That's different.
That's all I need to show. And The district court rejected this on the basis of or at least one of the arguments was to do with Illinois law not allowing impeachment of these sorts of, using these police reports. And I think that, that's wrong. And that's an important issue. This is a published opinion, after all. I think that's an important issue. And I think that it's clearly
wrong.
But
Judge Mannion made an important point, that if the witness doesn't sign the police report, then it's really, really weak evidence of what the witness said.
I don't think it's weak evidence. It's quite a detailed report. It's specifically ascribed to her. And
I know, but the police officer who writes a report, he's not a stenographer, right? He's not a stenographer. Is he a stenographer? Is this in shorthand?
No, he's not a stenographer.
Answer my question. Is he a stenographer writing in shorthand?
I do not know the answer, but I assume he was not.
Right. That means you can't get everything down.
Yes, but some of this was in first person. It was clearly being ascribed to her. And also,
yeah, but you can't, if you're not a stenographer and a person is speaking at a normal speaking speed, you can't take down everything the person says.
I think that it's significant here, as I pointed out before.
I mean, if I were the prosecutor, I'd be very comfortable with your impeachment. I'd ask the police officer, you know, are you a stenographer? Do you take down? Do you ever miss something when you interview a witness? And the police officer said, well, of course, I can't write down everything the person says. And then you ask her, well, did you everything you're testifying to? Did you tell the police officer? She says, no, I'm in the hospital. I've been stabbed. I don't know what I'm saying.
Well, according to the report,
it's not effective impeachment.
According to the report, she managed to tell them about a prior threat. Mr. Cole apparently told them about this statement. They managed to get all of that in. It seems to me that it would be reasonable to suppose, with the ASA there and realizing the importance of this testimony, that if it had been given, it would have got into the police report.
Yeah, but the prior threat was evidence of why she, as soon as he got on the bus, she jumped out of the bus and ran. That was that's what she was scared to death of him.
And those were documented. Those prior threats were documented by a restraining order of some sort, weren't they? She had already submitted complaints to the police about those.
She had restraining orders. Yes. Yes. I think my time is
okay. Thank you, Mr. Murphy. Ms. Stotz.
Court, counsel. My name is Retha Stotz. I'm with the Office of the Illinois Attorney General, and I represent the respondent. As some of the court's questions point out, there is no way petitioner can prevail because he can't possibly show prejudice. Even assuming his best case scenario, which is that the proposed impeachment would have completely convinced the jury that the victim's testimony that he said, I told you I was going to kill you, while he was stabbing Ms. Smith, even assuming that could have convinced the jury that that statement was not true, there was a wealth of other evidence showing intent to kill. As the court noted, the two stab wounds to the back. That's what the prosecutor argued in closing. When you stab someone, you intend to kill them. There were also the prior incidents where he slashed her face with a knife, twice threatened to kill her. And then there were his actions on the day of the stabbing. He's going to great lengths. He's at 8 in the morning. He's out chasing down a city bus with a concealed knife. The court asked, what was the knife like? It was a 5 to 6 inch knife, is the description. So there were the prior incidents, the prior threats to kill, the great lengths that petitioner goes to on the day of the attack to chase Smith down the street, broad daylight, in front of witnesses, including the bus driver Vivica Griffin and the bystander Willie Cole, both of whom confirm the victim's accounts of the attack. There's the stabbing itself, the severity of the injuries, 5 days in the hospital, collapsed lung, and then there's the fact that petitioner wasn't done. He didn't stab Smith twice and then leave. He only stopped because a passing car tried to run him down, and he had to stop. Based on all that, even without the statement, the jury had to find intent to kill with respect to Smith, so there can't be any prejudice. But counsel's decision not to ask the questions also couldn't have been deficient performance, and the court's questions touched on that. Partly because under Illinois law, to ask the impeaching question, counsel first had to show that the document they wanted to use to impeach was, in fact, a statement of the witness. So something like a deposition or a real witness statement, which is written out and signed, that easily falls within the witness statement category because it's in the victim's own words, which is one of the categories that counts under Illinois law. But if it's a document prepared by someone else, it only counts as the witness's statement if it's substantially verbatim. And we know from the police report itself that it was not. It says this is a summary. And it's clear from the way it's written that it was written by an officer. It says Belinda Smith relates as follows and things like that. So without more than the just from the face of the police report, counsel couldn't have even asked the question because it wasn't clear that the police report was the statement of the victims. And even assuming it was, to show that it was truly inconsistent, counsel would have needed to show that that the fact that was omitted was necessary to the narrative that the victims were relating, and or that it was directly responsive to some question that the victims were asked, and we don't know about what questions they were asked. So for that reason, too, the failure to ask the question wasn't deficient performance. Even assuming it was, there couldn't be any possible prejudice. Another basis to affirm is procedural default. The petitioner did argue in the state post-conviction proceedings that his counsel provided ineffective assistance, but under Stevens v. McBride and similar cases, that is not enough. He has to do more than say ineffective assistance in federal court and say ineffective assistance in state court. He has to present the operative facts of the claim he's raising in federal court to the state court. Here, his current claim is based on two things. The victim's trial testimony that petitioner said, I told you I was going to kill you as he was stabbing Smith, and then the police report, which doesn't mention that statement. Petitioner never presented these facts to any state court, much less presenting them through one complete round of state court review. And without those facts, there's no way the state court could ever have had any shot at evaluating the claim he's now raising. That means that the factual basis of his current claim is procedurally defaulted. Because he hasn't argued cause and prejudice, the default bars review of the claim. Petitioner's theory to get around the default seems to be to say that he raised the ineffective assistance claim on direct appeal. That's not true. His brief raised only a Krankel claim under Illinois law. He cited only Illinois cases in that section of his brief, no federal cases whatsoever. And he seems to concede that. He says, well, I raised the claim in the guise of a state law claim. Well, if you present the argument as a state law claim, it's by definition not fairly presenting a federal claim, and so it's defaulted. Finally, even if this court were to disagree and find that it really was an ineffective assistance claim and it wasn't a state law Krankel claim, it would still be defaulted because there was no way the direct appeal court could have addressed this claim because the police report wasn't even in the record at that point. The police report first made its way into the state court record in the post-conviction proceedings when petitioner attached it to his petition. So there was no way to present this claim on direct appeal. It needed to be presented on post-conviction, if at all, and it wasn't presented then either. Petitioners argued that we've forfeited this default argument by not raising it in our answer and our supplement to the answer. That's not true. We did raise the default argument in the district court, and we did so at the first available opportunity after petitioner made it clear that this was the particular factual basis for his ineffective assistance claim. And we gave a detailed argument as to why it wasn't forfeited in our SIR reply we filed in the district court, and that's record document 52. And the district judge seemed to agree with us that it wasn't forfeited because the district judge addressed our default argument. So three reasons to affirm the judgment: the procedural default, the claim is meritless, and also petitioner has forfeited any argument that the relevant state court decision is unreasonable. The relevant state court decision is the post-conviction appellate court's decision. That's the only court that considered the Strickland claim. Petitioner hasn't directed any attack at that decision. He's focusing on the direct appeal decision. We've also argued that the appeal should be dismissed for lack of jurisdiction. And that's because the notice of appeal wasn't timely. In this case, the notification of docket entry qualifies as the separate document under Rule 58. It doesn't contain any legal reasoning. He makes it very clear that petitioner has been denied all relief.
And yeah, but even so, the motion for an extension of time, that was filed within the 30 days, wasn't it?
It was.
So that has everything that a notice of appeal would have in it.
It doesn't clearly specifically indicate the litigant's intent to seek appellate review, and that's what it has to do.
It really does. No, it's all this business about the associate originally worked on this matter, is currently clerking. No, it's clear. They're not just asking for an extension of time to decide whether to appeal. We sometimes get with petitions for rehearing, we sometimes get. But no, I think it's clear that it's intends to appeal.
Well, just to articulate our reason as to why we don't think it is clear.
The only thing we are strict about is the time, the 30 days, the 10 days, whatever. But we have cases in which a motion for extension of time has been treated as the notice of appeal. Because all the relevant information is here. There's no surprise for the defendant, respondent.
We recognize that the cases are very liberal on this. I just want to make one point about what might make this case different. He's asking for extra time to do two things. Neither of those things is filing a notice of appeal, and one of those things is the exact opposite of an appeal. One of them is reconsideration in the district court. If he's successful on that, there's not going to be an appeal. So what sets this case apart...
Too late to file that, though, isn't it? Or is that what they're asking, an extension of time to file that?
To file a motion for reconsideration.
It could have been filed in 10 days, isn't it?
Right, and the time couldn't be extended anyway.
Right. So that's not even an issue.
That's true. Okay, he couldn't extend the time, but our argument as to why this case is maybe different is just that half of the relief he's asking for in this motion was district court relief, not appellate relief.
But there's irony, right? Because you want us to take this notification of docket entry, which is not a conventional, you know, Rule 58 judgment. You want us to treat it as that, which is fine, you know. But then you want us to be very, very strict about the motion for extension of time. And of course they argue the opposite, right? So it's not very edifying. Okay, well, thank you, Ms. Stotz. I think we understand your position. So, Mr. Murphy, how much time does he have? A couple of minutes? Anything further?
A few points, Jonas. The prosecutor did reference the statement in his closing, the I told you I was going to kill you statement. Was referenced in closing. Was the state clearly did place some emphasis on that, and it is, in fact, as far as I can tell, the only direct evidence of a contemporaneous intent to kill. I think
what's so strange is that most murderers don't actually announce to their victim what they're going to do, right? They just shoot them or stab them or something. So it's odd to regard a statement of the intent to do what you're obviously doing as essential to a verdict of guilt.
Well, it's the direct evidence of intent to kill, I think.
Well, I mean, that's ridiculous. Suppose you shoot someone in the back. And you don't say anything, you just shoot him. You're going to say, well, no direct evidence of intent? Just an aggravated battery? That didn't make any sense.
Well, it depends on where in the back you shoot them, I think.
No, it doesn't. You're kidding.
If it kills him, it doesn't matter, does it?
Well, we obviously concede that if he had been, Ms. Smith had died, then yes, he would have been charged with murder. That didn't happen.
But he wouldn't have been guilty, according to you.
Well, we're talking about a different set of facts.
No, we're not, actually. The intent issue is unaltered by what happens, right? Anyway, doesn't matter.
As far as the witness statement's concerned and the substantially verbatim requirement, I think that under Illinois law, I think Bassett is the governing case, and I think that statements were substantially verbatim under Bassett. Now, obviously, the witnesses would have to be shown the statements before they were admitted into evidence in order to confirm that those were their statements. But if the argument being made by the state
but it's not their statement. It's a summary of what they said. How could they say, this is my statement?
But well, you show someone something and you ask them, is that what you told the police during the interview? That's how you do it. And
some of what I told them, right? That's what she'd say. That's some of what I told them, yeah.
Well, she may say that. She may not. We don't know. Because defense counsel did not.
Or she'll say, I don't remember what I told them.
She could. But we can't assume that, and we don't know.
Never be certain of anything, right?
Well, that sounds like reasonable doubt to me.
Then you can never convict anybody because you can never be certain. That's your proposition.
If the prosecution is right, then you can never use these police interview statements. And I think that's wrong because I think they're used all the time, that witnesses are impeached on the basis of their police interview statements. We may not have an omission here. Maybe we have an ordinary old-fashioned contradiction. That can happen. And if they're right, you can never use those statements because all it says is summary. That seems to me a really bad policy to adopt because it encourages people to lie once they get on their stand because they know they can't be impeached by their prior statement. That seems like a bad result, and one which we shouldn't accept.
Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Murphy, and thank you for accepting the appointment and defending your client. You were appointed, were you?
Yes, I was appointed. Okay. The firm was appointed by the district
court. So thank you, and thank you to Ms. Dotz also. So our third case.